Transportation and Workforce Committee to order. We have some missing in action members, but we're going to get started anyway because it is now 3:10. I'm Vicki Walker, State Senator from Eugene, and I'll be chairing this committee this session. And I just have one rule, and I'm going to try to make sure and announce it every time, but you're all grown-ups. No cell phones, please. I'm a court reporter, and I'm real picky about things like that, and that's one of them. So if you have a cell phone and it makes noise that I can hear, you need to turn it off. And if that doesn't work, then we'll think of other measures that make you remember. But I would really appreciate it if at all times you'd put your phone on vibrate and take it outside to have your discussion. We have people who come here to give testimony, and they need to be respected. We have two other members are here. First, we have a quorum, so I'd like to adopt the rules. My vice chair, Senator Starr, could you make a motion?
Yes, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt the rules for our committee as published.
Thank you, Senator Starr. The Senator moves to adopt the rules. The only change from last session is that we have 48 hours notice of meetings. Is there any discussion about that? Hearing none, the rules are adopted. Can I get to bang the gavel again? Yes. I'm going to have fun with this for a while. I haven't held a gavel in my hand since I was chair of the Lane County Democrats. That was a little bit like herding cats, and that was many years ago. So this will be kind of fun. The next thing I'd like to do before we bring up our honored and esteemed guests is to start out with just a little introduction of our members who are seasoned members that you probably all know. But there could be someone out in TV land who hasn't seen or heard of you before. So, Senator Morissette, could you start, please?
Thank you. Senator Bill Morissette, representing Senate District 6, which is parts of Lane and Linn County. I live in Springfield. I served as mayor. Well, first of all, I taught school at Springfield High School for 28 and a half years. I was on city council for 2 years. I served as mayor for 10 years. I've been in the legislature since 1999. I have been on the education committee, and I have a T-shirt with the names of all of the people that have killed my bills, and I see some of them here. education is the number one issue for those who respond to any kind of a survey. So it's an important issue in the state of Oregon, and it's very difficult times, but our committee, I'm sure, will do what we can to support and enhance the education program and maybe even the budget. Who knows? Probably not.
Senator Charles Starr, I represent Senate District 13, parts of four counties, Sherwood and Washington County, Newburgh and Yamhill County, Wilsonville and Clackamas County, St. Paul and Kaiser and Marion County. It's a pleasure to be here. I'm a lifelong educator, certified to teach in 1955, have been involved at the school board level and in the formation of private Christian schools. I'm very much interested in seeing us improve performance for those who are underserved in our public school systems today, and we'll be working very diligently with my fellows on this committee to do good work. I thank you for your help and assistance. We don't do it without you.
Thank you, Senator Starr. I did not know that you were a teacher all these years I've been in the legislature, so I appreciate hearing that today. I'd also like to introduce our committee assistant, Don Tuso, on the computer. And Marjorie Taylor is our able-bodied, excellent, most excellent committee administrator. I'm just so delighted to have Marjorie with us. So if you can't get in to see me, which will be frequent because I'm in committee 8 to 5, 4 days a week, Marjorie's your gal, and she's going to keep us on task, and if I get too crazy with the gavel, she'll let me know. I wanted to just give you a little bit of an overview about where our committee's going over the next approximately 13 weeks. We're going to start out with K through 12. I hesitated doing that, but I thought, well, we might as well jump in with both feet and go for the big one. So we're starting out with K through 12. We're going to be on this issue for a number of weeks. We're going to be doing a road trip in early February, and we're going to be talking about education service districts on that road trip. Then we're going to jump into higher education and the Oregon University system. And then from there, we'll tackle community colleges and workforce development, which is the other part of our title of our committee. We are taking workforce development issues on the road as well. We're still trying to figure out where we're going. We have a good idea, but we're not ready to make that announcement yet. That committee goes on the road in April, correct? So we are going to be a very busy committee, and I also serve on the education sub of Ways and Means, so nothing will get past this committee chair on education, because I'm going to be coming at it from both ends, and I'm really looking forward to that. It is a new idea that our leadership has discussed this session for. The policy committee chairs are serving on the corresponding Ways and Means subcommittees. I've never been on Ways and Means before, so it's a little bit of culture shock because I'm a policy wonk. But I find it's going to be really fascinating to tie the two ends together. It won't be in a nice, neat little bow, but it will be fun getting there and hopefully instructive. So with that, I would like to start our Department of Education overview and bring up the honorable and esteemed Susan Castillo, Superintendent of Public Instruction, along with Pat Burke and Vicki Fleming with the department. And if you could just state your name before you speak the first time, that would be great.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. It is great to be here with you on this Martin Luther King holiday. I think we all remember that Dr. King was very focused on children and creating schools that provided equal opportunity for all children in this country, and that is very much the focus of the work in the state of Oregon. I just also want to, for the record, I should say Susan Castillo, State Superintendent of Public Instruction for the state of Oregon. We at the department are very interested in working with you in a collaborative relationship. Please call on us for any assistance or information that you need. We are here to serve you as best we can. And I just want to call your attention to some of the materials that we brought for you today. We provided you with this year's annual state report. Card. It's a great resource to answer those very common education questions that come up these days, and then the report is also available on our webpage if you'd like to look at it through that. The last few years have been challenging for educators, as you know, and while budgets have declined, expectations have remained high here in the state of Oregon, of course, and from the federal government. And the good news is that Oregon students were a close second in the nation with their high SAT scores and performed better than 45 other states on the ACT test. Oregon's dropout rate continues to decline, and more students graduated and attended college than ever before. The greatest education challenge Oregon faces is eliminating the gap in achievement between high-performing students and students challenged by language, disability, and poverty. Now, when I took office 2 years ago, I brought in business leaders to review the department's structure, our focus, and our business practices. And as a result of this review, the department was reorganized this last year. The new structure streamlines the department and improves internal communications and service delivery. And with the reorganization, accountability is now the central function of the department. We're working on developing a more comprehensive accountability system that will provide the public and our educators with timely and accurate information. Last year, I announced six priorities for the Oregon Department of Education. First, we want to help children be ready for first grade, and to this end, we're helping districts in the design of their kindergarten programs and helping them with possible sources of funding, such as their federal funds. Secondly, we want to close the achievement gap and have all students be successful. We've provided statewide training and resources to teachers and administrators on No Child Left Behind requirements, as well as strategies to close the achievement gap. We're working on assessing individual student growth from year to year, so we'll know if every student is progressing at an expected rate, whether they are talented and gifted students or students with disabilities. Literacy remains a priority. We've worked with hundreds of educators to be better reading teachers by training them to identify early reading difficulties and intervene before young readers become frustrated and turn away from reading. The department has been awarded a second round of federal Reading First grants, and I know Senator Starr has a special interest in that program. Oregon is set to receive over $7 million each year for the next 5 years, and these grants are targeted to the schools that need the most help. School and district leadership is critical in the success of students. And through the department's efforts, the Wallace Foundation has awarded the state of Oregon $700,000 to strengthen education leadership in the areas of cultural competency and K-12 literacy. The department supports making every school a community school. Last year, the department received $4.2 million of federal funds as part of the No Child Left Behind Act to fund new academic and enrichment programs during out-of-school time and education and family literacy opportunities for the participating children's adult family members. And we expect additional funds this year to continue this effort. The need to improve middle and high school students is urgent. Test scores show that Oregon high school students continue to struggle. Only one in three high school students met the federal standard, and high schools met the federal standard, and fewer than 15% were rated strong or exceptional on the report card. So we're working on making high school more meaningful to students by requiring schools to develop an education plan for each student and expanding opportunities to earn college credit. And before I conclude my remarks, I'd like to say something about state funding. A school budget of $5 billion, which is currently proposed, will result in additional cuts in school programs. There's no doubt about it. And I believe that Oregonians care very much about the quality of their schools, and I don't want to see more programs cut in a shortened school year due to lack of funding. We at the department are committed to student success, and I hope that we can work together to support Oregon by supporting our local schools. And we welcome your suggestions on improving the accountability of schools, of districts, of education service districts, and of the Department of Education. And now I'd like to turn the microphone over to two members of my team. Vicki Fleming is the deputy superintendent who will describe the department's mission and our recent reorganization and our work with education service districts, and Pat Burke. Dr. Burke is the chief policy advisor who will talk at greater length about our focus on accountability.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, again, Vicki Fleming, Deputy Superintendent, Oregon Department of Education. We're very pleased today to give you a brief, high-level overview of the department that will set the stage for hopefully a more in-depth exploration of additional issues in the coming weeks. The intent today is just to provide you a snapshot of responsibilities of the department and answer any questions you may have, and many of you already know this, so pardon me for being repetitive if you've heard this before. Essentially, I think we exist as a department, as a state agency, to answer three questions. What is happening with the investment that taxpayers make in the enterprise of public education? What's happening with and for students as a result of that investment? And then when things are not working, what is happening that to be done about that? And as Susan mentioned, we have been undergoing and are to be continuing the process of reorganizing over the next months and years, in fact. The statutory responsibility of the Oregon Department of Education is to oversee a system of standard public schools, kindergarten through 12th grade, for Oregon's 198 school districts and 20 education service districts that serve at this year nearly 600,000 students each day in Oregon. Just for the sake of context, the department's operational general fund budget is right around, as the governor recommended it, at $36 million, 1.8 of which is a policy package that we'll talk about later to fund an integrated data system. We have approximately 250 plus or minus people that work at the Department of Education, and another 200 that work in the schools for the blind and deaf, and in fact work with youth corrections education programs. Again, for the sake of context, 250 bodies, full-time equivalencies at the agency, is about the same amount of faculty and staff employed by Reynolds High School in East Multnomah County. Again, for the sake of kind of historical reference, over the last four biennium, the department's number of FTE has reduced by about 30 people, and our operational budget has been reduced by around 18% over that period of time. I'll tell you a little bit about the workload increases as a result of No Child Left Behind later. It's the mission of the department to provide leadership for an effective, accountable, and comprehensive education enterprise in Oregon. As Susan mentioned at the start of the 2003 session, the superintendent laid out a list of priorities that included a well-run, efficient, and accountable Oregon department. Superintendent Castillo also outlined an ambitious set of goals, not the least of which was this reorganization and improving the department to be more focused on results. And the planning that went into that reorganization has been ongoing for the last 2 years, and the implementation really took place beginning about 1 year ago. It was designed to address the changing dynamics in both Oregon and at the federal level, specifically in the post-Measure 5 environment. I don't need to remind you that Oregon's educational system is now largely one that is state-funded as opposed to based on local property tax revenues. Once less visible in the distribution of state school support money, the department has now become a critical tool for the management and accountability of those funds that the taxpayers invest in the public education system. In addition, the expectations surrounding student achievement continue to grow. The federal No Child Left Behind Act has provided an additional focus on accountability, with increased requirements for collecting and analyzing data about individual students, as opposed to what we focused on in the past, which really is more aggregated information on schools and school districts. In other words, the Department of Education, and in many ways the entire Oregon education system, is in transition, attempting to meet ever-increasing expectations in an era of financial constraints. Faced with these new realities and guided by three primary goals, accountability, leadership, and school improvement, department managers have developed a reorganization plan that has been designed to break down silos and to work across disciplines, to become a full partner with higher education and community colleges and the workforce development system that you referred to earlier, to assure that every Oregonian has a chance to a quality education. As Susan mentioned, we have worked on a streamlined organizational structure. Our executive management team is smaller than it was several years ago, and we have now five offices that operate the department. The first I'll talk about is the Office of Educational Improvement and Innovation. This office really is responsible for the development of academic content standards, federal programs, and professional technical education. Those three functions used to be in three separate offices, and now they're combined into one. And in the past, this resulted in sort of interesting behaviors in the agency. If you were around in those days, the development of the Certificate of Initial Mastery was developed in the Office of Curriculum and Instruction, and the Certificate of Advanced Mastery, in fact, was developed in the Office of Professional Technical Education. Now those people work together, and the specialists are able to compare their particular philosophical views of how high schools should look and how education should look in general, and I believe it's a superior way of thinking about our work. And by the way, the combining of those three offices resulted in the number of managers going from 13 down to 6. The Office of Student Learning and Partnerships is responsible primarily for direct services to children, so that's a combination of early childhood, youth corrections, education, hospital programs, and programs for special needs children. Emphasis on the functional responsibility for partnerships. Staff in that office work across agency boundaries with staff from the Oregon Commission on Children and Families, Department of Human Services. We work with government-to-government groups, and we have several grants that really require us to look at our community-based initiatives, including the Healthy Kids Learn Better grant that really focuses on the health and well-being of young people. That's funded by the Center for Disease Control. A new office that we did not have and have newly named is the Office of System Accountability and Policy Development, and that unit is primarily responsible for collecting data, analyzing it, and putting it back out in the form of reports that help people understand what's going on. And the inordinate number of requests that office receives lead us to the conclusion that we probably need to add more staff there rather than less. But we have also internally listen very hard to our partners in the field who say, you ask us for too much information, and sometimes you ask us for the same information in different reports. And so would you please take a look at that? We have looked at the number of surveys that we collect in the agency and reduced those, albeit not significantly, by about 15%, and are looking hard to continue to do that. The Office of Assessment and Information Services is a combination of what was formerly assessment and evaluation and technology. And since most of the information that we collect is done through means of technology, and assessment is one of the most important things we do and one of the biggest investments that you make, these two things are working better in concert with one another as a result of this merging. Much of the agency's energy and attention is being directed toward collecting and analyzing data in order to meet state and federal requirements, as I mentioned earlier, down to the individual student level. That's a lot of information to process. In addition to that, however, we recognize the critical importance of direct technical assistance to local schools and districts for teaching and learning, and I'm going to talk a little bit at the end of my remarks about how the department wishes to leverage Education Service District resources to help with that direct technical assistance. And we also look forward to an open, frank, and honest discussion about the complex technical environment there that we are in and some of the challenges that we've faced with that assessment system, some of which you probably read about in the newspaper, but we look forward to that conversation. And lastly, the Office of Finance and Administration, business and accounting functions typical to the agency, and also where the state school fund gets managed and distributed. We've made much of our improvement in those processes in terms of implementing centralized procurement, and the development and awarding of contracts has been improved greatly. We have someone placed in charge of that function now and has been very aggressive about making sure that we're doing that impeccably. We've automated our grants management for the entire agency so that each office doesn't have to figure out its own way of accounting for those dollars, but rather we do that again through technology. And most recently, creating more accountability when it comes to how local districts are spending state school support funds. You'll be hearing more about that as well. Briefly, I want to tell you about three other actions. We've hired an internal auditor that is assisting us with analyzing risk and business processes. We are now one of the few state agencies to post summaries of our internal audits on our public website. As I said before, we've worked hard to eliminate some of those redundant data collections, and we have worked very hard at a collaborative partnership with education service districts that has resulted in a memorandum of understanding that more clearly defines the relationship between the state agency and ESDs and the transactions that go between us, largely in the form of millions of dollars worth of contracts for direct services for young people. I want to say just a couple things about ESDs, and then I'll close and pass the microphone to Dr. Burke. Our reorganization at the department was largely predicated on the development of a regional delivery system in partnership with ESDs. As I said, we find it very difficult to continue to provide all the direct technical assistance that schools and districts express a need for and to accommodate all the accountability functions that have been added to our plate since the implementation of No Child Left Behind. The that law requires a system of support for school improvement. When we look around Oregon and look for a place where that function might reside more logically on behalf of all the 198 districts, ESDs step right to the fore of that role. They also help us with the direct service delivery to students, with communication to districts, and with training and professional development for teachers and understanding changes in programs and the law. So we've worked very hard over the last year with that constellation of education service districts, and I believe are looking forward to a proposal that they are working on that is largely reflective of that negotiation between the department and those ESDs, and hope that you'll be looking forward to hearing that proposal and how they think things might work on their own behalf. So I just close by telling you that we have a management structure and new tools in place to deal with the new realities of education in Oregon, with the ultimate goal of doing the public's work so that things work better for the young people that are enrolled in our public education system. And we look forward to working with you in the future to explore more in depth on any of those topics. Thank you.
Thank you. Ms. Fleming, before we go on, Senator Starr has a question.
You mentioned in passing the integrated data system that you're working on. I had the opportunity to visit with the Education Commission of the States, Idaho, and the work they've done with the Albertson Foundation in implementing an integrated data system seems astonishingly complex, yet providing information that we've never had before about individual students so that they can be tracked not only within the school, but between schools when they move. And it's if you haven't had the pleasure of viewing their system, it would be an eye opener, I think, for us. It's very, very complete and functional.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, thank you for that reference. It's we're in the era of the more we know, the more we want to know, and that system and the use of technology will be the only way that we can convey that data and have it be relevant and meaningful to folks, and that's our goal as well. So thank you, Will. I believe our manager, Doug Kosky, knows about that Idaho system.
Thank you.
Thank you, and I'll have some more questions about data collection when you're all done, but we'll move on. Mr. Berg.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, good afternoon. I'm Pat Burke, and I'm the Chief Policy Officer of the Department of Education. It's a real pleasure to be here and look forward not only to our conversation today, but conversations throughout the session, and certainly want to offer any support that I can to the committee for the challenging work ahead of you. I think what I would offer this afternoon briefly is some expansion of the conversation around accountability. You've heard Superintendent Castillo and Vicki talk about how this has become a more central focus of the work that we do and how we're organizing around that critical function. Let me just briefly talk about that. The Oregon Constitution in 1859 directed the legislature to establish a system of uniform common schools. So from the very beginning in Oregon history, the focus was on the provision of educational services. We provided those services through a variety of ways, in general terms, in the beginning through the election of county superintendents who had the responsibility for drawing district boundaries, levying and collecting taxes and distributing funds to provide that system of common schools. In 1922, the legislature added compulsory attendance to this, but the basic focus of providing for the schooling of youngsters continued in Oregon law. It reached a high watermark in 1939, where the state of Oregon had 2,100 school districts, and we have, just by way of reference, 198 now. And beginning in 1939, the legislature began a focus on efficiency and reorganization, and some of that work continues even to this day. But by and large, the focus from the legislative and policy point of view was to empower local districts to provide schools. That changed significantly in 1990, and the accountability and policy framework went through, beginning at that point, some very significant changes. In May of 1990, the voters in Oregon passed Ballot Measure 5, which required the capping of local property taxes at 1.5% of assessed valuation, and only 5% of that would be devoted to schooling. And the state was then under the law to make up the difference, and making up the difference came from state income taxes. So within a one-year period of time, a balance of about 85% revenue coming from local property taxes and 15% coming from the state reversed itself, so that most of the funding for education after 1990 came from the state with a relatively small amount from local sources. In addition to that, at the same time, you will recall that the state passed an equalization formula requiring that the per student amount distributed to the states, now through the state, would reach parity over, took about 4 years to reach that parity, and that the funds would be distributed equitably throughout the state through a weighted formula that recognized that some students would receive additional funding based upon handicapping, condition, poverty, or other factors. That was followed very quickly in July of 1991. The legislature passed House Bill 3565, better known as the Oregon Education Act for the 21st Century. That made a very important watershed event in the question of accountability, because at that point the focus on providing schools shifted. And it shifted to what are the outcomes, are the results of schooling in Oregon. It was a very important shift. The legislation required the establishment of clear, what were called in the law, outcomes, or what was happening, what were students learning as a result of attending Oregon schools. Two sets of those outcomes were created. One set was called Core Applications for Living, the other were called Foundation Skills. And the Department of Education was directed to come up with a system to collect information on whether or not students could demonstrate those skills. The law contained language that said that it was the intent of the legislature to certify that students had learned the skills established in law. That certification process became known as the Certificate of Initial Mastery and the Certificate of Advanced Mastery. All of that watershed event took place in 1991. By 1995, 4 years later, there was some dissatisfaction with the specificity of those outcomes. The concern was that the voters, policymakers such as the legislature and others, needed more precise information on the on what students should know and be able to do in the state of Oregon. So the department, under House Bill 2991, was directed to redo those standards. And that became the content standards established by the state in six areas: English language arts, mathematics, science, social sciences, fine arts, and second languages. And the department was directed to establish performance measures for those standards. So if you will, the content standards are the what that students should learn, and the performance standards are the measures of how well should they know that information. And that information led to the creation of the state assessment system, which was first then implemented in 1996. That's the system that is currently in place now. By 1997, the next session of the legislature, another significant change in this evolution about accountability took place. The 1995 session provided more specificity about what students should know. the 1997 session focused on what do we know about schools. And the 1997 session created the state report card. And the state report card directed the department to establish measures for school performance and to report those measures publicly and to rank every school in the state on a 5-point scale from exemplary to unsatisfactory. The law further specifies that that accountable information needs to be submitted to the districts no later than January 30th every year and must be sent home to parents of the schools no later than March 31st of every year. We continued with that system from 1997 forward until January 8th of 2002. On January 8th, 2002, President Bush signed into law the No Child Left Behind Act. And the No Child Left Behind Act added additional levels of accountability to the existing system. And at this point, I'd like to talk about how these two systems compare and contrast, because I believe that's at the focal point of where we are right now. Both systems require the collection and publication of information in four areas that are on the surface similar, but they actually look at the information in slightly different ways. Let me be specific. Both No Child Left Behind and the state report card require some indication of participation rate in the state assessment system. No Child Left Behind requires 95%. The state offers a range of participation in the assessment system. Both measures require looking at student performance. How are students doing in our schools? The state report card, however, looks at that information in an average over a 4-year period of time, and the No Child Left Behind system looks at a single point in time and does not look at information other than a single year. Likewise, there is a very important difference in terms of how the information is collected. The state report card looks at only that average information. No Child Left Behind asks the additional question, how are students for whom English is a second language doing? How are students who have disabilities doing? How are students of various ethnicities and racial categories doing, as well as the general average of the school? Another comparable area is a question of growth. The Oregon report card, in our opinion, very appropriately so, looks at student growth over time. It actually looks at 4 years of data and averages the two oldest years and the two most recent years and calculates whether or not the school is showing progress over time. No Child Left Behind does not do this at all and specifically limits the use of growth in analysis. Another example is the state report card actually looks at students who have already exceeded standard but holds schools accountable for those students continuing to make progress. The federal system does not look at this at all and specifically prohibited the use of looking at information for students above a state's standard. So the result is that you get some information on growth in the federal system only after a school has failed. And at that point, a school can look at whether or not the students not meeting standard decreased by 10%. In that degree, there's a buzz term that is used in the federal law. It's called safe harbor. And a school can demonstrate meeting standard through safe harbor. But again, you only get to safe harbor after being identified as not making progress. And then finally, both systems look at something called behavior. And actually, in my opinion, neither system looks actually at behavior. It looks at dropout rates and attendance. But again, the systems are slightly different. The dropout rate under the state report card is a 1-year average. The dropout rate under No Child Left Behind is actually calculated as a composite of 4 years, a cohort that began in ninth grade, and 4 years later, how many of those kids graduated with a standard high school diploma. So what's the result of this? What you have are two systems that on the surface are measuring the same thing, but in reality have different measures. and I believe has created confusion and a lack of clarity of how policymakers would use this information. So that it is possible that a school could be exemplary on the state report card and not make progress under the federal system. That kind of lack of specificity and lack of clarity is confusing to the public in general, and I think is not very helpful to policymakers such as yourselves. So what do we intend to do about that? What we would like to do, and I'm calling your attention to a one-page handout that was given to you earlier. We've set about process to try to fix some of these problems in accountability. It will take a while, and we have divided it into two phases and four specific tasks. The first, and probably one of the most important, is to clarify how school districts plan for improvement. Currently, under the existing system, they're required under state law to submit a district plan. They are also required to submit a federal funding spending plan. They have to submit a plan for federal expenditure around professional, technical, and career education programs, and they submit a special education plan. We are integrating these plans into a single continuous improvement planning and accountability model that would integrate not only the planning process but the budgeting process to provide a more comprehensive and more focused plan. Secondly, our technology around financial analysis has improved. We are now utilizing something called the Secured Student Identifier. I hate to use acronyms. You may hear this referred to as SSID. And basically what this is a unique number that is assigned to every student in our system. And what this technology allows us to do is monitor the progress of a student any place in Oregon. The current model, without this system, we were limited to, in our data analysis, to just students within a certain district, and it didn't follow students from district to district. So by using this technology, we can not only look at where the money within the financial system went in a district based on the category of student, we also have better information on what results were generated as a result of those expenditures. The next phase is to try to integrate these two report card systems that I described earlier. We think these two systems need to come together in a more equitable and clear fashion and eliminate some of the confusion. And then finally, to clarify the intervention steps, and the problem here is that intervention under the federal model is restricted only to schools that receive federal funds. And the intervention under the state report card is somewhat limited in its scope. To be specific, if a school for 2 years has been low or unsatisfactory on the state report card, they are required to submit a revised school improvement plan within 90 days. On the other hand, if you go to the other extreme, if a school in or a district in Oregon is found to be substandard for two consecutive years, the law requires that their state school fund be withheld. So what you have are two bookends of an accountability process with nothing in the middle that's focused on improvement over time. Under the federal system, the first intervention is to allow students the right to transfer to another school or to receive after-school services. Again, that system also does not focus on long-term school improvement planning and district improvement planning. So what we'd like to do is integrate these into a more clearly understandable model, one that is clear to the public and is perceived to be more fair and more accurate. And that's the work that we've embarked on. So thank you, Madam Chair, and we're open to any questions you might have.
Thank you, Mr. Burke. Senator Morsett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm looking at the 10th grade math report card, which is not too good. Some of it's inconclusive in that you don't have it all compiled. during the interim, we talked about this, and did you change the 10th? Okay. You're testing the 10th grade. The part of the criticism is that people don't take the class until they're in the 11th grade or the 12th grade. Is the 10th grade the right time to test? Did you make any adjustments on that schedule?
Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, no, we have not made specific adjustments. We have, though, studied this question pretty extensively, and we look forward to an opportunity to talk with you in depth about it. We did do an analysis of whether or not the existing state benchmarks actually predicted performance in the 10th grade. What we found is that the 10th grade number appears to be a pretty strong number. What was interesting in the analysis is that the earlier benchmarks at grades 3, 5, and 8 may in fact be too low in terms of a trajectory for all students reaching 239. The second issue is the one that we want to discuss with you further. We have a concern that there may be a structural problem in that a student that continues to take only 2 years of mathematics may not be receiving an adequate amount of instruction to perform to standard on the state's standard. And that would imply either adjusting the standard or adjusting the amount of instruction they receive. And those are elements that we look forward to an opportunity to talk with you about.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Starr.
Follow up on that question, really, and you've partially addressed it. But my sense is that we have not high enough requirement for math and or science and English language, that with 22 credits required for graduation, we're below standard as far as relating to other states, and that we should look at the possibility of raising that requirement to some figure above 22 credits for graduation. I think that students should have 3 years as a requirement of math, 3 years of science, 4 years of English. That is not now required. Is it too onerous? I don't believe so. Mm-hmm. I think it's demanded of us for when we look to a better educated citizenry for the century and preparation for college. So I would hope we would consider that as we look to the future, possibly raising the graduation standards for our students.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, we certainly agree with your perception and we look forward to that analysis. It's a complicated picture because particularly in areas like math and science, you're talking about having to have teachers that have the appropriate license to teach in those content areas. So you'd be talking about expanding the number of teachers. In addition, without adding to the number of courses offered, one solution is to have more required courses and fewer elective courses. And as you know, elective courses are very important to the lives of our young people, and in some ways they reflect why a kid engages in the school. So it's an important issue. You are absolutely correct that Oregon's requirements puts the state in about the bottom third in the United States in terms of the number of units of math and science required for graduation. We are not alone at two, but it certainly is very clear that there are other states that require three. There are a few states that actually require four, but by far the most common breakout nationally is 3 units of math and 3 units of science. I would say, though, that Oregon, back as 10 years ago, has always made a distinction between credits and courses taken and what does the student know, what evidence exists that the student can meet standard. And we know that some students can find exposure to instruction in a variety of ways, online, community college courses, summer school courses that aren't necessarily picked up in just the units of credit that they have earned. So the state assessment system gives us some idea of how much mathematics do they know, how much science do they know. But we anticipate that this conversation is one that would be conducted during this coming session. We have a lot to talk about in this area.
Thank you.
And Madam Chair, if I could just add to that, and Senator Starr, we do have a number of districts that have set their own requirements and are and do require more math and science for graduation in their districts. So the districts have gone ahead and taken the lead on increasing the rigor in their programs at the local level. So, and we have a number of them who are doing that.
Well, I have a number of questions, but given that it's 4 o'clock and we're going to hear from another panel, two other panels, I don't want to take too long, so I'm just going to ask a couple of my questions now, and you're going to be around a lot. In fact, I think every Monday and Wednesday will be a 4-hour day for you, given that the House Committee meets right before we do. I just want to talk, I really want to say how much I appreciate that you have streamlined your administration. I think that's one thing that I hear from the public more than anything else, is that we're always so top-heavy on administration. And there's two things I want to talk about. One, I want to talk about audits, but first let's ask, you know, we all talk about making sure that we get more dollars to the classroom. That's my goal, and I'm sure that's your goal. Let's define what we mean by the classroom so that we're all on the same page. So how do you think we achieve that goal, and what is it that we're trying to achieve? Does that mean that we have enough instructional assistants, enough teachers, enough supplies? I mean, I think we need to define that right out of the chute, and then we can talk about it the rest of the session. So I'll throw it open to either one of you to answer that.
You will be hearing, Madam Chair, you'll be hearing later today about the quality education model that is operated by the Quality Education Commission. That is at least one very precise measure of some of the factors that you've just described. And the data that go into the quality education model analysis are drawn from what is called the Database Initiative, or DBI. Now, the power of DBI is that a common chart of accounts was implemented when DBI was developed about 6 years ago now, I know maybe even 8 years ago in that session, which means that school districts report their expenditure by common definition. So we can calculate using DBI the specifics of what the districts in the state spend on certain elements of classroom instruction. So how many districts are putting classroom aides in the classroom, what's the source of the revenue to pay for those, and what does it cost? So we can be more precise using the quality education model about those factors. So then there are, therefore, policy issues. Do we, for example, attribute transportation costs to classroom costs? Most people would say no, that transportation is a separate cost. Or heating, lighting, and air conditioning costs of schools. Is that an operational cost, or is that a direct classroom cost? That's where the quality education model can give us important tools to really separate that out and define what we mean by classroom instruction. I think the one of the more common assumptions is that that should include the salary of the teacher, should also include some notion of supplies and materials, textbooks, and so on. But it may also need to include, what is the percentage of students with disabilities in that classroom? Or what is the percentage of students for whom English is a second language in that classroom? And how does that impact the overall cost of services that are delivered in the classroom? And I think what you'll find is that the quality education model gives us some very good tools to answer those questions.
All right, great. And that sort of dovetails into my next question about audits. And Superintendent Castillo, I think we talked a little bit about that, the audit that Secretary of State's office did this year and released on May 19th, an analysis of spending for K-12 support services. And I reviewed that, and they claim in their audit that more than $162 million for that last year could have been redirected into the classroom if certain things had been done differently. And one of the things that doesn't appear to be consistent is districts aren't utilizing group bulk purchasing of certain items. They're doing things a little bit differently. They're not learning from one another what one district does to save money and another one does. But also, I don't think the chart of accounts or the database initiative is really where it needs to be at this point in time. And I'm going to ask a question. There is a question here. This morning in the Ways and Means Committee, we learned about orbits and how all the agencies have to report under orbits so that you know how every agency is spending their money according to every other agency. So I think there's some flaws in the way that each district is reporting this information, and I think I saw that, Superintendent Castillo, in your answer to the audit report. You said this is a very timely report. The report highlights the importance of taking Oregon's database initiative to the next level. So can you just briefly talk about that, because we're going to get into the DBI database initiative later on, but this report raises a lot of red flags, so maybe you could just give me a heads up where
we're going. Well, it does raise flags, and we welcome the audit and actually have asked for the audit, and we plan to, you know, follow the recommendations and absolutely do the work that addresses the issues that are raised in the audit. But yeah, we have some work to do to improve our databases in the state, to have a more seamless flow of data between districts and throughout the state and our system, and we are continuing to try to move in that direction. Not only with just the flow of that whole chart of accounts work, but also in the academic part of the data that we collect as well, and our assessment data systems as well. And we do believe that there is some work that needs to continue to do to continue to improve the data, because it's more important today than ever, because so many of our decisions are based on the data that we have. How do we better direct the resources that we have to get the most from the investments that we're making to create success for kids, and how do we put more efficient practices in place to make every dollar we have stretch more to the classroom. And I'm not really prepared today to really go into detail about what the work is, but we could absolutely follow up and get some folks here in front of you to get more specific about the work that we're looking at and improvements that we believe do need to be made, and to really make sure that we have the information, all the best information we could possibly have to make good decisions about the entire education system in the state.
Well, I appreciate that, and I didn't want to corner you today. I just want to give you a heads up. We're going to want to look
absolutely
at that, and it sort of goes with what you were saying, Mr. Burke, when we changed to the SIM and CAM, and we changed to outcome-based education. We can't measure that if we don't have a way to collect the data very carefully and evenly across the system. So I do want to learn more about that, but not today, because we don't have enough time, and we have a whole session to learn about those things. And I appreciate all of you coming. Did either of you have any questions?
Just a short question about the Senator Marquette. You mentioned internal audit. What? Mm-hmm. Tell me about that.
Mm-hmm. Madam Chair, Senator Morissette, our internal auditor was hired a little less than a year ago to help us look at the risks that are represented in the work that we do, and are there ways for us to improve the way our business processes and technical requirements in the agency work. So he started with an audit of the youth corrections education programs and looked at a variety of things. Do we have a clear mission? Do we have a contracting procedures? Do we communicate well? And that, in fact, is the audit that I referred to earlier that is posted on the public website. He has been a delightful addition and has asked us some of the hardest questions that any of us, I think, have ever had to face. And his job is to drill deep into what we do and expose to us any thing that we might need to look at further.
May I? Mm-hmm. Is he an outside auditor?
He is employed by the Oregon Department of Education. He is not a part of the management team. He reports directly to the deputy and then to... Yeah. So he is to remain pure and objective in his view of the agency.
Okay. I appreciate knowing that. Thank you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, all three of you. I appreciate you coming, especially since you already testified today.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee.
You're welcome. We're going to get Steve Bogart on the phone, who is chair of the State Board of Education. He's on the other side of the mountains where travel is less than ideal. Also in the room is Emilio Hernandez, who's the vice chair, and Randy Harnish. If you could come forward while we're doing that, that would be great. And Mr. Hernandez, I understand you hail from Eugene.
Springfield.
Well, that's close enough.
We got to watch out, Emilio.
Actually, Madam Chair, I remember working with Mayor Morissette when he was mayor. I was on the very first Human Rights Commission.
Yes.
We were back. And
during our time of stress.
Yes.
Mr. Bogart, can you hear me?
Great.
Thank you. Mr. Bogart, this is Senator Vicki Walker. Welcome to our committee.
Well, thank you for the invitation.
I hope your weather is getting better over there, though this time of year is very unpredictable.
I do want to thank you first for the invitation, and secondly for allowing me to, I guess, appear at least vocally before you and not require me to cross the state in this kind of weather. I really do appreciate that.
You're more than welcome. I do want to let you know that in the room at our witness table is Emilio Hernandez, who you're very familiar with, and Randy Harnish, who I'm sure you know as well. And so what I'm going to do is let you start out as chair and just give us an overview of the State Board of Education, what you do, what you expect out of your position, and what you expect from the legislature.
Well, thank you, and I trust that I can rely on Emilio and Randy to help me out and clarify things. Emilio is our senior member, and of course Randy is our executive officer. So, guys, if I omit something or there's a little different perspective, please jump in.
Okay. I think they will. Take it away.
Okay, thanks. I'm not real sure in the way of introduction. Sometimes, hopefully you have bios of board members, the current roster of board members and things, but the board, as you well know, is charged with overseeing the public education system in the state, and has a myriad of responsibilities as it relates to that. And our charge is to follow direction from the legislature and the governor as to the goals and the end results for the board. I want to make the committee well aware that we have been working arduously for a number of years since the early 1990s to implement education reform. Reform is happening, whether formalized or not. Our education system is far different now as it was a decade ago. And trying to be responsive to those changing needs, and especially in light of the organizational and financial limitations on the system is a huge challenge. We do have a number of issues before us, and hopefully Randy indicated that you would have our one-page principles and kind of a work plan sheet in front of you.
Yes, we do have that.
I'll quickly run through what I see are some of the, to me, significant issues on why we're conducting our business. On that sheet, the border to the left indicate kind of the process we go through. At the top of the page is our goal, and that's so students actually have the skills and the knowledge necessary to enter the workforce, to proceed on with advanced learning, and actually to be responsible citizens of the state. We have a number of outcomes that we hope advance that, and those are the six boxes that you see. And those are consistent with at least my hope and my understanding of the legislative actions that have taken place in the last 10 or 15 years. To do that, at the bottom of the page, we have some specific actions that we hope to take, or let's say strategies to move the agenda, if you will, to I guess facilitate enhanced learning. I'm not real sure what kind of questions may arise. So I'll, I guess leave that for your questions at that time. The board is comprised of people from various, I guess, careers and stations in life across the state. Emilio, I guess, could you introduce the board, if you will? I'm assuming they have a roster in front of them.
Mm-hmm. Yes, they do, Steve.
Mr. Hernandez, could you state your name for the record?
I'm sorry, Emilio Hernandez, Vice Chair. Madam Chair, members of the committee, right now we have two vacancies. But the current members that we have are Jerry Berger from the 5th Congressional District here in Salem. Then we have Duncan Wyatt from the 1st Congressional District in Portland. Nikki Squire, who is the second Vice Chair, she's at large from the Bend area. And then Steve is from the Baker City area, and I come from the 4th Congressional District in Springfield.
Mr. Hernandez, could I interrupt just briefly? Why is it that there are two vacancies, and how long have they existed, and are they filled by appointment by the governor?
Yes, they are filled by the governor, Madam Chair. It's my understanding right now that one person is being looked at, and I'm not certain about the other one. Do you know anything about that one, Randy?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, actually, those two vacancies, one represents a position that vacated early last spring, and then one that a position that vacated just late this past year. And yes, we are working with the governor's office, the governor's education and policy advisor, as well as the executive appointments official to identify folks who are available and interested in serving on the board. And we have been working with Mr. James Sager and other folks from the governor's office in that respect.
One of those appointments has been vacant since late last spring?
Correct.
That's quite a while.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
And Madam Chair, if I may continue, we also have a group of advisors. We have Dr. Robert Silverman, who is president of the Mount Hood Community College, who advises us on community college issues. And then we have Jerry Wilson, superintendent from Hermiston. And just recently appointed was Roger Will, who will represent counselors, and he is from the Central High School in Hillsboro.
Great. Are you going to take over now and talk a little bit, or do we want to get back to you, Mr. Bogart?
Actually, we're not very well coordinated. I was hoping to be in Salem today, and we'd have a few minutes to compare notes and hand things off. So we're kind of winging it here.
That's quite all right. You're doing pretty well so far.
I do want to thank you for the indulgence. I guess I did notice the absence of protocol as far as addressing the committee, so forgive me my informality. First, not being there, and second, not being all that familiar with the protocol.
Well, that's quite all right, and you're on a telephone, so sometimes protocols just sort of get overlooked a little bit, and that's perfectly all right. Mr. Hernandez, do you want to talk a little bit?
Yes, I can,
okay.
Madam Chair, I can take over from some things that Steve has addressed that I don't want to be redundant from what Superintendent Castillo and other staff members have mentioned, but one of the things that the board is really working with and trying to stay in step with the department is the reorganization of the whole department itself. It has become much more coherent that way, but there's a lot of folks that are wearing a lot of more hats, to be frank about the issue. But it's an issue that has worked well thus far, but during this times of the session, you'll probably be seeing people come in that you see the day before talking about a whole other issue and a whole other arena. And that is part of the outcome of the reorganization. And the staff that Superintendent Castillo has put together have been doing an excellent, excellent job. She had a meeting with some of the Latino leaders, I think it was the week of New Year's, I can't remember exactly when it was, and it was to deal with the issue of where we are with the achievement gap. And that achievement gap has been a major issue with the state board for several years at this point, primarily around the second language. We do know that the dropout rate has reduced, but at this point the communities of color are still somewhat concerned with that rate, as is the department, as is the board. We are working towards everything that you see on the sheet that Steve referred to is very, very inclusive of all children. And as we go around the state to different meetings and different boards that we've talked to, this has continually been an issue of how are we going to meet these standards from the federal level, from the state level, if we have an increased number of students that are second language learners, or who just recently arrived and have no English capacity whatsoever. And the department has really done, in my view, as a second language learner myself, I went to school only learning Spanish. And in those days, we didn't have resources we have available now. And in my view, the department, in traveling around the state, has done an excellent job in providing resources to schools that are encumbered with a huge number of these students, let alone the low SES factor that plays in with that, that brings numerous other issues to the school to deal with. And I think the department has really kept all of those issues on the front burner. And I feel very comfortable in being a part of this board and knowing that we are working on these things all equally and not saying, well, this isn't an issue right now, we can deal with it later. They are all on the front burner and all being looked at equally.
Could I ask you a question, Mr. Hernandez? And I don't know that you have the answer, but on the note of diversity and recognizing our growing ethnic and racial population, do you know if the Department of Education has diversified its own workforce and how many persons of color they have working in their department?
Well, Madam Chair, that has been a question that's been on the table for several years. And we, as people are being replaced or being positions being reduced, it's difficult to bring other people in. But that is something that Superintendent Castillo has been looked at, has been looking at. Now, there has been some people that have left that were of color, but at the same time, the community is concerned that there be more folks of color on staff and in those different various positions. And I know that Superintendent Castillo is looking at that as well, as is the whole department, as we move through this reorganization and bring people in. As I travel around the state, that's the first thing that's asked. How many people on the board are of color? How many people on the staff are of color? How many are bilingual? How many come from Native communities? And these are hard questions, and these are hard questions that the board has put to the department that need to be addressed.
Mm-hmm.
And we are looking at that.
Thank you. Senator Morstead has a question on...
Yes. Vice Chair Hernandez and Chair Bogart. This is an even tougher question. In 1999, I was on the Education Committee, and the last Superintendent Bunn came to our committee, and at one point I asked him about the division of power between the Board of Education that was appointed by the governor to set policy and the superintendent, who was elected by the people to carry out the policy, and whether or not an elected official had some sort of preference over the power of the appointed positions. The answer was kind of brief and a little bit confusing because I don't think you really want to talk about that too much. Could you comment on the division of power as you see it between the board and the superintendent?
Steve, do you want to go first or do you want me to address that?
Actually, if it gives me the opportunity to at least begin the discussion.
Okay.
I want to commend Superintendent Castillo because she has changed the approach instead of focus on an allocation of responsibility to a pursuit of some mutually recognized roles. So instead of trying to figure out who has the responsibility or who has the opportunity to supersede or undermine, we've worked very closely to set some mutually agreed upon goals and directions, and have worked closely together with that. There's a natural, I guess, friction, which probably is pretty good, is a good thing to have in that, well, who's responsible for, and to have that question asked. But I've got to say, in the last 2 years, it really has been a very positive working relationship where there has been a focus on what we hope to accomplish together.
Thank you.
Madam Chair and members of the committee, what I would add to what Steve has suggested is that I have worked with Vicki and Pat and Superintendent Castillo in different areas of the state and been called at home or at the office and saying, can you be at this meeting? Can you come and help me with this or that? So there really hasn't been this ego trip between the department and positions, as you kind of alluded to a little bit earlier. But I feel comfortable with the different department heads calling when they need something or asking for information, that it's not a hidden thing behind their position or behind their own power. It's an issue that they want to have the department work as a whole. So I really feel that the division of power is minimal at this point. I think it's definitely a concept of teamwork between the board as well as the whole department itself.
Good. Thank you.
Chair Walker, if I could address that for a moment, too. Again, for the record, my name is Randy Harnish. I'm the executive officer for the State Board of Education. And I included in the few handouts that we gave you this kind of flow chart. And I hope I tried to keep the boxes to a minimum, but in kind of advance thinking of your question, Senator Morsett, this is an attempt to kind of put the pieces into some kind of context, and I hope that it helps rather than creates more questions. But as you can see, where the State Board of Education fits, as you described, is it exists both as a under the direction of the legislature, because its existence is defined in statute. The process for it to exist, defined in statute, calls for the governor to appoint those seven members, and then back to the Senate for confirmation. So, as I think Steve described, there is just by design kind of an intentional conflict's not the right word, but there's an intentional tension. Mm-hmm. And that tension, I think, is part of the genius of the design, which is to build in that checks and balances, that you have both branches of government as well as the input from the judiciary in the direction of the education system in Oregon takes. We have the publicly statewide elected official as a head. We have the governor appointed, Senate confirmed board member setting policy, and we have the Department of Education operating under the direction, general policy direction of the board, but under the direct administration of the superintendent. And so it is, as you say, there have been some times when the tension was greater, and I think the institution survived that, and I think has moved on, and as Steve described, I think we're in a position now where the board and the superintendent and thereby the Department of Education are working together to maintain clear lines of communication, advance notice of work and decisions that are made, so that we all can focus on the prize, which is, as Emilio described, seeing every kid in Oregon achieve to the highest possible level. So again, if this helps, great. If it doesn't, just crumple it up and leave it in the can as you're going out the building.
I think it'll be fine. Senator Starr has a question for you.
Comment and a question. Earlier when the state department was before us, I raised the question of the minimum standard for graduation. Is that a part of the continuing discussion, or is it something that's kind of a sideline issue? I personally feel that 4 years of math, or 3 years of math, 3 years of science, and 4 years of English should be a minimum requirement, and we're not there. Do you discuss this as a part of policy setting for our state?
Chair Walker, Senator Starr, if you'll notice on this one-page document, the big box at the bottom, number one, the first bullet is clarify the standards required for a high school diploma. So I think the answer to your question is yes. This is an issue that has been raised to the level of the board, and it's an ongoing discussion. The question now is, I think, safe to say, it's not whether or not that's a good idea, but how best to make that happen in a way that is the most impact and the least problems.
Thank you.
Gentlemen, I have a question. I was reading your outline, and I appreciate that, about your goals. Could maybe Mr. Bogart, you can answer this for me. I know that by statute, your board is required to meet with the Board of Higher Education. Can you tell me if you are meeting your statutory guidelines and working with the state board as you are directed to do?
To be perfectly honest, Madam Chair, we have struggled to meet the minimum requirements. However, recently we have begun meeting. We met in December. We will meet again this Wednesday, and then the full joint board, that's the working group that's met, and the full joint boards will meet the first week in February. So we now have, because of the turnover actually on both boards, and I guess a little lack of focus on the parts, we haven't met nearly as often and nearly as productively when we have met as we need to. But we have taken those initial steps, and there is a commitment now to not only be in full compliance, but actually to advance the mutual agendas that in many ways are complementary. So, short answer, yes, we have been, but only minimally.
Well, I appreciate your answer, Mr. Bogart, and I was afraid that was going to be your answer because I've done a little research on that, and I've been very, very disappointed because our goal is to have a seamless education system and work with community colleges and universities to help our students not only enroll in dual credit systems and have other post-secondary opportunities, but they can't. You can't do that. You can't work together if you don't meet. So I'm at least glad to hear that you are taking that seriously. And I'd really like to get some kind of a report from you as to how this next set of meetings goes and what you intend to do to make sure that you meet those statutory requirements.
I'm sure that we will be happy to provide that report in whatever fashion you want on that, because it is exciting that we actually have sat down and had productive discussions.
Great, thank you. Didn't we get everything you gentlemen wanted to speak about? Mr. Harnish, you didn't really have a great deal of time to do a presentation, but...
No, I think...
Okay.
if you have a general sense of the structure, that was our goal for the afternoon.
Yeah, and I don't know, do either of my colleagues have a question? Okay. I just wanted to make sure that we were tracking in the same way as we all think we are. Mm-hmm. And I know that the board seems very intent on reducing the dropout rate and the achievement gap. That seems to be clear with the documents you've provided and what you've discussed with us today. So I hope we have an opportunity to talk later on in the session about your progress.
The only thing I would add, Madam Chair, members of the committee, is that you're going to be receiving a lot of information, as you have already today. But as Vice Chair and Steve, I'm sure, as the board, or as the Chair of the Board, we would be more than glad to continue to meet with you, because we meet monthly here, and I'm up here a lot for other things because of my work. But I think that the more that we meet, the more that we can dialogue about these. As you go through all this information, you're going to have questions come up, obviously, because this is a very confusing process for all of us, and it's the requirements of it. Schools, administrators, principals are very concerned about the requirements that are being put on them, particularly around the issue of scores for students that are second language learners. And that has been set as a priority on this sheet that's been given to you, and as the board looks at this as well, because we don't want those children to be used as excuses for not testing them or providing them the services that they need. But we need to be honest and have them be included in everything else that every other child is receiving in those buildings, so that we can truly give Oregon taxpayers an honest view of what's happening in those buildings. And so, yeah, as the Vice Chair, and Steve will probably agree, that we'd be more than glad to meet with you upon your request at any time.
Thank you. Senator Morsett, yeah, do you have a question?
Very briefly, thank you. Pat Burke is in the audience, and I guess my question is to everyone in terms of the schools, the rural schools that are at risk of having to, you know, limit numbers of hours and classes and maybe even losing accreditation and so on. And so that's something that I think we need to have an update on as time goes on.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And I want to tell you how much I appreciate your emphasis on second language students. I mean, these students are very much a part of Oregon, and they deserve an education that is befitting all of our children. And so I know that you're all dedicated to that task, you as well, Mr. Bogart, and I appreciate you appearing by phone today and the rest of you coming here in front of our committee. And we look forward to a further discussion and a continuing relationship.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do appreciate your indulgence to visit my phone, and I do look forward to visiting with you and other members of the committee, because I do seem to get to Salem rather often.
Yes, that happens to the best of us. All right, thank you, Mr. Bogart. We're going to disconnect now.
Great, thank you.
All right. Thank you, gentlemen,
thank
very
you.
Much. And then last item on our agenda, which is here in all this paper, is to hear a report on the Quality Education Commission and model, get an overview. I think that's Pat Burke again and perhaps Ken Thrasher.
I guess I should say good evening.
Yeah.
Getting close.
It's getting close. Okay. If you could state your name for the record and just take it away, that'd be great.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Ken Thrasher. I'm the chair of the Quality Ed Commission, and with me today is Brian Reeder and Pat Burke. You guys want to introduce yourself?
For the record, again, I'm Pat Burke. I'm the chief policy officer for the Department of Education.
I'm Brian Reeder. I'm the director of the Policy Research and Analysis section at the department.
We appreciate, Madam Chair and Senators, the opportunity to come and give you an update on the report for this session. We just posted the new report of the Quality Ed Commission's report on the website, so it is now out there for everyone to look at. We wanted to get it out early in the session so you all had an opportunity to view the report. I think there's a lot of really good data in that, and what we brought is a kind of a brief summary of the findings in the report and information. I'd like to take you through that and just let you ask questions, or if you want to just ask questions, we can do that, whichever best fits you. But I have some, I think if we kind of go through this, we can kind of frame and help you with frame some of the questions I know that are going to be important in this session for you to deal with. And as chair of the commission and being involved in education in Oregon for probably 30 years now, I think the important element here is you always start with the end in mind, and that's student outcome. And so I want to focus on the first six slides on student outcome results because of, I think, not only what they show but what the challenges are and the fact that the reason I think the commission was formed was to look at excellence, what it's going to cost, and what outcomes we should expect if we invest in a quality education system. And when you look at the student achievement results, I think there are two significant issues in the charts on the second page. One is the reading chart on top, and the second is the math chart on the bottom. And those, I think, the significant issues are, one, the slope of change, and looking at what's happening in our schools, especially that relates to each of the four grade levels we're measuring, 3rd, 5th, 8th, and 10th. And also the impact of students as they go through the system. And I think there's a critical piece here to look at. Is if you look, for instance, in 1996-97, a third grader, and then you go out 5 years and look at an eighth grade score, and 7 years and look at a 10th grade score, you're going to see something you won't like, and that's a significant drop in performance. And that is not acceptable in anybody's means. And I think we need to, as we look at how we deal with our education system, start to further address that, because part of that is the achievement gap that we'll talk about. But if you go to the next page, so I think if you kind of now take to the next page, what this imposes is what No Child Left Behind requires. And the difficult part of this is that 99% of students being a standard by 2014 implies a very steep slope, especially at the middle school and high school level of performance. And so the effect, the cohort effect that we've been hoping would occur over time as students went through the system, while we're getting some increase, we're not getting the level of increase in those later grades that we need to achieve. And if you, part of that reason that I will tell you that I think that's happened is as we have dealt with some of the funding challenges we've had, especially in the last four or five years, the result is that high schools have taken the biggest hit in the funding per student. And some of the work that the Oregon Business Council has done and we have done isolates that issue as being a real challenge. You know, we've kind of dealt on the front end to get third and fifth grade up to speed, but high schools have kind of been trapped with not getting the funding necessary to bring their scores up. And so as we talk today, I think we really need to look at that. And the other big issue is that what happens at the middle school. Why does it that students that go through third and fifth grade achieving a nice slope, which is now leveling off with funding challenges that we've had, why is it that at 8th grade and 10th grade they drop? When they go into a new structure, we know that there's a problem in those middle schools, and we need much more research on that to determine why that cause is there. It's not something that we should allow to happen, because we're making this challenge to get to No Child Left Behind a very difficult process with both the process we have in education and the funding challenges that we're faced with. If you go to the next set of two pages, this dissects the information into the impact of the achievement gap by ethnicity. And I think here that the real issue here is not just ethnicity. It's issues around special needs and ESL needs, as you heard about earlier, poverty, the impact of poverty on our students. And I think if you read the paper in Sunday's paper, which is, even though it's in Portland, it talked about what's happening with poverty with students in both the city and the suburban schools, where we're seeing significant increases in number of school with free and reduced lunch. That is a challenge, and the demographic changes that we have going on in the system today are putting a great amount of pressure on both the cost structure and our ability to achieve performance standards with the level of funding we have and the programs we have. So I think we need to address that. So what is the role of the commission? The role of the commission is simply to help policymakers understand the relationships between funding and student achievement, give you the data to help you understand how that works, identify key policy areas that might impact our ability to achieve higher accountability, efficiency, and adequacy in the system, and that's what the model starts to do, is looks at best practices, research-based information to determine how you would price that and put that in the model to increase the outcomes that we have, and then how you, if you're looking for dollars of change, where do you apply those to get the biggest impact? And I think overall, I think a new concept that we introduced in the report this time is the challenge in Oregon is with the funding challenges and with performance challenges, we have historically put all of our education systems in silos, pre-K, K-12, community colleges, universities. And we're advocating that we step back from the process we've had and undo that. We need to look at education as a continuum, pre-K through 20, because quite frankly, we're not going to get that 20% grade 3 that aren't standard up to standard if we don't deal with some of the pre-K issues we have coming into the system. Kids are not prepared and ready to learn. And at age 3 and 4 is when you can have the most impact on, based on brain studies, on their ability to be prepared for the learning environment. Now, 45% of our kids today aren't in any formal preschool or program that allows them to deal with some of the challenges they're going to be faced with when they hit the K-12 system. So we need to understand that and fix that, because it's a lot cheaper to do this preventive stuff in those earlier years than it is to try to deal with it in high school. And high schools are dealing with the problems from middle schools, and middle schools are dealing with the problems from grade schools. That reciprocal accountability problem, where we've let the silos manage independently and not hold each group accountable along the way, is one of the challenges that we have to deal with. So we do try to estimate the funding requirements of all the policies that we put in. It generates a very large number that no one in Salem likes to talk about, but the reality is it's a number that's based on current structures, but best practices. Are some of those available to be reduced in cost? Absolutely. There's some efficiency opportunities, but there's also the issue of funding and some other things we'll talk about. And we're going to meet the requirements of No Child Left Behind. We also have to start to measure between the 92% level we're at in the model that we're measuring today to get to 99. And quite frankly, that is the most difficult, the most costly group of students that we're going to have to try to move through the system, because they're kind of the high-need, special-needs students, which now represent about 13% of our student base. So what we've tried to do is take a focus that really aligns around three things: accountability and governance, efficiency, and adequacy. And I'm going to use a new term here, adequacy. A lot of people call it quality education. With the buzzword in education today, there is a term called adequacy, and it touches a lot of areas that we're going to talk about in this report. On the accountability and governance area, integrated data systems between pre-K and 20 are absolutely necessary for us to have data to manage student outcomes, to track those students through the system as they go, know where we apply the proper resources when the student's off track, to help parents understand when a student is getting behind in their education, because they can go on a website, they go with a security code and look at how their student's doing the day before in class. They can deal with it. Not every parent can do that, but the ones that can, we want them to have that capacity. And for us to intervene and prevent wherever we can. That's going to take an effort between all elements of this pre-K to 20 system to make that work effectively and make those strategies. Now, the department is starting that. They've got some good work going. We need to enable them to get that done, because the two elements that you've talked about, I heard earlier, database initiative, which I was involved with the regional formation of, so I could tell you that we have never put the money into that project to bring it to scale on what you wanted it to do. And that project should help us manage costs and demographics so that we know the inputs coming into the system, where there are differences between districts, how we can leverage buying and purchasing and other opportunities in this state, and leverage that capacity that we aren't leveraging today, and then the assessment piece, which is what we're talking about here with the integrated data system on accountability. That should be connected with universities so that students that are doing very well can get credits in high school and can be moved through the system efficiently. This should not be a fixed time-based system where K-12, you're in the system for 13 years and then you go out. If a student's available to go out in 10 years, or 11 years, because they've got the capacity and knowledge, they should be able to make that shift. The reciprocal accountability is a very simple term in the data model. What it should do is hold the system and the teachers accountable in the system for what happens while they have the charge of that student. And so where we've passed students from grade to grade with individual accountability in the classroom, when they move to the next level or move from K to 12 to community colleges, what happens is the accountability is gone. All sets should be held accountable for that student's performance. And if a group of kids is falling behind in a classroom, we need to find out what's wrong with the classroom. That's a whole separate issue. That means you have to have a personal education plan for each student, which the database model will do, that allow us to really focus on those kids that are dropping out so we can look at the issues of rigor, relevance, and relationships to figure out where we have to apply resources to that student, and it will start to close the achievement gap that we have that is growing today because of the demographic shifts in our student base. We need to tie that all to one element that I think is absolutely necessary, and our state has never looked at it from this point of view, and that's a state economic model. So we understand the impact of putting the money front end in the system instead of paying for it in corrections and social services. Example, the Packard study just completed a study on special needs students in pre-K that went through age 3 and 4 classes. They traced them all the way through the system, and what they found is that for every dollar invested in pre-K, they saved $11,000 for every student in the pre-K system. They saved $11,000 in the K to 12 system. On the other end of that, those special needs kids, they saved a 7-to-1 ratio on per each dollar invested. That's a longitudinal study that says that investment pre-K has a huge return in those outcomes further on down the system. Those are the kind of things we need to do, because if you look at the slide that's attached underneath this chart, we try to do is take and give you a picture of what's happening in our system today with students when we don't invest. And that slide is very clearly evident here. And what you look at here is the impact of high school dropouts, high school graduates, kids with some college, and graduates from college, the amount they pay in Oregon State taxes and property taxes into the system versus the services they use on average for incarceration, unemployment insurance, Medicare, Medicaid, welfare, food stamps, reduced food, lunch programs. Each of these students that we're not getting to a higher degree of education is costing us money. We have to change that. That's the economic opportunity. How do we put more in the front end investment to reduce those social costs at the back end? Over time, it'll take time, we should be able to create a real positive impact to the state budget. On the efficiency side, there are a lot of different ideas and things that people have talked about, consolidating ESDs from 20 to 10, combining the data systems into the data integrated data model we talked about for structuring healthcare. And here I think the key is focusing on engaging the participant in its management, not just paying the bill and making sure participants are responsible for healthy lifestyles, and providing incentives for that. Review the delivery systems around ESL special needs students, our transportation system, the number of school districts we have, and the size of those districts, and the cost it is to maintain those, and the ability and the need to improve our teacher training programs to make sure that we have the best class and world-class teaching staff in place. Those are some of the efficiency opportunities that we talk about in the report. A few years ago, we brought up PERS as being a big issue. And fortunately, we've taken that on and dealt with some of that. But we have a lot of other issues that if we're going to build trust in the state, we have to deal with some of those issues. On the adequacy side, which we'll get into the funding components, there is a need, I think, to adequately fund pre-K to 20 programs. And right now we're doing that with local options, which have two risk factors. One, their sustainability, and two, the risk of equity and legal challenges. There are four states right now that are going through legal challenges over their equity systems. And we moved to equity, and now we've gone away because we've allowed this shrinking resources at the state level not to deal with the problem. We need to develop a clear strategy around those pre-K programs to engage as many, I think up to 100% of our age 3 and 4 kids in the programs, to get them at standard by the time they get into the K to 3 part of our system. And then we need to continue to really leverage our best practices around reading initiatives for pre-K to 5, measuring the effectiveness of our small learning communities primarily, which we are engaging today in the high school system, and the review of the middle and high school structures. High schools today, we're asking them to do a better job, but they're being fed a group of students today that aren't in position to be doing a better job. We have to deal with the middle school structure as a system that's not performing at a level we can live with. And then we need to support families and students with services they need. We have far too many kids today that are latchkey kids that are in the system that aren't being dealt with because of the loss of after school and other activities that used to be there that budget cuts have taken away. As we look at the funding issues, the gap is widening. We showed you four current models and then the quality ed model here. The essential budget originally in 2003-05 was $5.1 billion. We lowered that to $4.9 billion with the final funding due to the cuts that we had to make. And the essential budget level for this year, based on all the cost factors we've looked at, which include an increase of about $100 million in wages and salaries at the districts. It includes a PERS pickup of $160 million, which is done at the state level. It's not done at the local level. And includes health and other increases of about $160 million. When you look at that, you come out to about $5.3 billion. The governor's proposed $5 billion, so you can see we're about $300 million apart just to meet cost increases at the current level of education. So that's the challenge, is can we live with that without finding other significant dollars and ways to feed monies into the system? How are we going to survive on that with the current programs we have? The quality ed model does call for $7.1 billion, and there's a full set in the model of all the pieces of why the difference is there. It is class size, it's length of school year, it's advisors, counselors, it's ESL. It's all of those things we talk about in here. They're in there. Can we get there immediately? I understand that's a real difficult problem. We can't do that. So we have to figure out a phased approach that gets us at least moving on the path to correcting this dilemma. Because our trends are, we're down about $500 on the next slide per student. When you adjust that for inflation over the last 14 years, we're down about $500 per student, or about 15% adjusted for inflation on our funding for school, our school children. Part of that should be some efficiency, but we have had real cost increases. And so the reality is we are not keeping up with the needs of our system. Demographic trends are a very important issue that a lot of people don't talk about. Our student growth has averaged a 1.1% compound growth rate since 1990. But if you look at the components, special ed, 3% annually, ESL students, 15.4%, and poverty, 5.3%. Those trends are eating away at our core funding. And if you actually look at it, those special need programs and other programs that are coming along are eating up the dollars, with less and less dollars going into the classroom for the balance of children. And so we're really stretching the system to be efficient. And during that same time, our population on minority students has gone up to over 20% of our student population, while our teacher base is around a little over, or right around 5%. That creates a cultural and social issue for our schools to deal with. And it's one where part of the training and education for existing and new teachers has got to start to deal with that issue, to deal with the problems of children in poverty, of minority and cultural differences that are coming into the classroom. And we aren't even beginning to really deal with those effectively. The implications of not doing this is larger class sizes, a shortened class year again, some cuts in teachers, extracurricular activities, reduced programs for students that need special needs, among other things. A lot of different cuts that will affect education assistance. So we're just, I think, at the point where we're concerned that if we stay where we're focused on a 5.0, the impact will be a longer school year. And we'll see the flattening effect in the graphs that I showed you earlier, which are flattening and now starting to decrease. We could see an acceleration of that without adequate capability to deal with those issues. We've kind of laid out how, if you had additional dollars in this next table, and I won't spend a lot of time going through this, but I think it's also important to come up and say, if you're going to spend money, where do you spend it to get some bang for the buck? And what we've tried to do here is give you some dollar impacts in a biennium basis of different changes that will have an impact on outcomes for our students. There's a whole list here. I won't go through individually them, because we're going to have some time, I'm sure, to talk about that and relate those. The question we should do to relate that is, what impact should it have on outcome? What should it do to student scores? So our recommendations as a commission are want to establish a pre-K to 20 integrated education data system, get that moving along, create a governance and accountability task force to provide recommendations for the effective accountability structure. The question you asked earlier about the state board on what they're doing with the higher ed board should also be asked, what are we going to do with pre-K education and issues when we're going to cut $11 million out of that budget? We're going to aggravate that issue. So we should be looking again collectively in community colleges how those groups are communicating to create this connectivity and leverage the power of the group. We need to provide additional funding at the elementary, and if we're going to put it anywhere, we're going to put it in a reading that's a foundation skill. That also means teacher training. You can't just say we're going to put money in reading and it's going to happen. You've got to also educate the teachers on best practices in those reading capabilities if you want to deliver on that process. And linking to that, earlier in the grades, things like SMART, programs, third-party programs like SMART, that come in and help kids in the classroom. They need to be connected earlier, not later. And we need to look at how we can do that effectively. Look at the pre-K issues, continuing expansion of the high school. I would call it re-engineering instead of restructuring. And then provide targeted staff development dollars to help our teachers, especially reading, cultural, social challenges they're up against, deal with some of those issues effectively.
Thank you, Mr. Thrasher. I think Senator Starr has a question.
You've hit on the subject that's very dear to my heart, and that's equipping teachers to teach reading. And I submit that a teacher who is licensed to teach K through 3 or K through 5 should have had best practices inculcated in their training and should come out prepared to teach reading properly. It's not happening. Why don't we have more emphasis on that? How do we gain some momentum there? That's where dollars are wasted. And today, of course, we're retraining teachers all across the state because they weren't properly prepared when they left college.
Well, an interesting challenge, too, is as our young people go into college, about 1/3 of them are taking some form of remedial training or retraining in college to deal with the fact they didn't get it earlier. Now, maybe I'll just let Pat answer that question, but there are some opportunities. Pat?
Well, Madam Chair, Senator Starr, first of all, we agree with you 100%, and so let me just touch on a few things. First, as you know, because you have contributed your time and energy to some of our advisory team meetings, we have expanded the focus of the Reading First grant, which is by a federal regulation limited to K-3, but we have expanded that task force to include the entire spectrum of grade levels to see if we can involve more partners in looking particularly at middle school and high school literacy. Secondly, and I won't go into the details here, but we have had conversations with Teacher Standards and Practices Commission on the very issue that you're talking about. To what degree is reading instruction required as part of licensure? And in particular, I've had an opportunity to talk with all of the deans of the schools of education that offer licenses in the state. And this notion of secondary literacy is really taking hold in the colleges of education. And I hope you would have an opportunity to hear from some of the deans on how they are incorporating this into their programs. In a nutshell, you can become a secondary licensed teacher in the state, as you've correctly pointed out, without really knowing anything about secondary level literacy. That is an issue that clearly has implications in terms of the instructional expectations at the high school level, which are different, obviously, than at the elementary level. So that leads me to my third point, is we are funding high school projects in the state. We have we've set aside some of our general fund grant and aid funds as well as grant funds for demonstration sites where schools are taking on the question of high school literacy. We're funding that in two ways, as I mentioned, general fund, and we're using some of our Wallace Foundation funds. So we just recently in August participated in a high school reform summit, and we're working with districts and high schools to identify how they could approach the improvement of literacy at the secondary level. Clearly, this is not just the responsibility of the English teacher. The amount of writing that is done across the curriculum in math and science, for example, more technical writing, or the ability to read complex text materials such as history text and science text, demands more careful attention to literacy than just what happens at the elementary level. So we agree with you and look forward to an opportunity to talk with you more about it. But I would say that this is an idea. As you may recall in the last session, we identified this area of secondary literacy as one of our priorities, and both the universities and the school districts are stepping up to focus on this area.
Further comment that might lead to a question, if I may.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
The quality ed model certainly highlights issues across the full spectrum, but it seems to me that what you failed to address is the blue ribbon schools that with current funding are actually getting the job done, and how that might relate as far as reform within the system to get more bang for the dollars that we're spending. We know that there are schools, saw one elementary school in Northeast Portland that was so turned around by an administrator that it was just absolutely astonishing. And they did that with available dollars.
Yes.
And so school leadership to me is another whole area that's really wanting for improvement and reform.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, again, you have your finger on a very important issue. Would love an opportunity to come before you and talk about the State Action for Education Leadership Program that is focusing on high school literacy as one of its targets. As you may be aware, last year we held the first ever Closing the Achievement Gap Summit in the state. We held that at Portland State, where we did identify schools that had evidence of actually closing the achievement gap. Oregon schools brought them together at Portland State so that other schools could come and learn from what they are doing. We are repeating that event in April, and this time the demand for it is so high we are now going to have to move it to the convention center in the evening to recognize the schools that are in fact closing the achievement gap. So the daytime part of that program will be schools coming to learn from other schools in the state about their practices and what they're doing, and the evening event will be a celebration of those schools that have closed the achievement gap. We need to do more of it, and you're absolutely correct.
Thank you. Senator Starr, I don't mean to cut you off. I have to be in Portland at 6 o'clock, and I don't think I'm going to make it. So, Mr. Reeder, I haven't heard from you. I'm going to give you 5 minutes, and then we're going to need to close our committee down so I can get to my obligation.
Chair Walker, members of the committee, Brian Reeder, Department of Ed. I'm here primarily in support of Ken. I am with the Department of Education, but also staff to the Quality Ed Commission, and responsible for the sort of day-to-day nitty-gritty estimation tasks related to the quality ed model. I'm here today primarily to answer questions.
Okay, great. I think, Mr. Burke, did you have anything else you wanted to add today? Or
Madam Chair, I'm aware of your time constraints. Let me just make one quick observation and an offer. There's a lot of attention focused on that bottom line number, but frankly, the quality education model is more useful as a diagnostic tool rather than a justification for a certain number. We would like to offer you and members of the committee, there are a variety of fairly simple software applications that are available for you to be able to use information, for you to ask questions of the model, and to assist you in your analysis and your work, and we'd love an opportunity to come share that information with you.
Oh, I would love to hear that and see that, because I really am invested in what the Quality Education Commission is done. I appreciate your presentation today, Mr. Thrasher. It was very thorough. And, you know, $7.1 billion, it's a big number, but I agree. It's a tool. How are we achieving what ultimately we'd like to achieve? And really what I want to know is what strategic plan do we have to at least get close to that number? And that's kind of where I'd like to have a further discussion. But I appreciate all of you coming today, and I look forward to having you back, because I know you'll be back.
Madam Chair, Senator Starr, I appreciate it. And I just a comment. I think you have a wonderful resource in Brian, and please use him, because he's very capable at helping you look at some of these policy issues. And you hit it right on the head. This isn't a two-year picture.
Mm-hmm.
This is a continuum. And if we're going to ever change the types of spending and where we're spending money, when we increase corrections budget over 30%, and education's going up too, you have to ask yourself the strategic question, are we doing the right things? And I think that's what this is all about. And we should engage the higher ed system, pre-K, same kind of model, same kind of analysis. Use it as a diagnostic tool to help you make good decisions. And that's what we're here to help support you with. So
great.
Thank you very much.
And thank you. With that, this committee, which is now a subcommittee, is adjourned until Wednesday.